Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. So this week is another episode in our occasional series on American Variety that I call Genderology. You might have noticed that over the past few years, men have been portrayed in the media, in TV shows and advertising in particular, as being increasingly inept and silly and weak and often just downright stupid. So several years back, we did a show in American Variety that I called The Shrinking Man. In recent years, this trend of disparaging and weakening men and maleness has expanded, I think, into the broader culture and has begun more and more to reflect the actual reality. Men really do seem to be getting weaker. It's probably a good thing that it's no longer a man's world, but the opposite extreme is not a good thing for society either. My guest today is Dr. Richard Reeves, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., who studies this phenomenon and its social implications. There, he leads the Boys and Men Project and has written a book called Of Boys and Men, Why the Modern Male is Struggling, Why It Matters, and What to Do About It. Welcome, Richard.
Thank you for having me on, Cole.
It's great to have you on. So if we accept the premise that American men and maleness have lost a lot of their identity and are struggling to know how to be what they are, what I'd like to do, I think, to start off is for you and me to alternate reasons why this is so. In other words, contributing factors, we could call them. And then we'll pick some to talk more in depth about. So I'll start. One, I think, is the dissolution of the traditional nuclear family, in particular, the absence of fathers in so many boys' lives. So now you.
Another one is the change in the economic power relations between men and women as a result of women entering the labor force and becoming much more financially independent vis-a-vis men.
Yep, certainly that's a good one. Another would be, I think, the portrayals in the media that I talked about in the lead-in, which in effect are a kind of low-level propaganda, really.
Yeah, and I think another one is the blurring of the lines between like what's men's work and what's women's work. That used to be a pretty clear division of labor, and that's really pretty blurred now.
Okay. These are all good so far. And I think maybe sort of related to that in a different way is the nature of professional work that increasingly doesn't favor aggressiveness and dominance as it did, you know, 50, 60, 70 years ago, but instead collaboration and teamwork and mutual respect and generally being nice rather than tough.
Yeah, I'd add to your list, I think, just physical strength as well. The share of jobs that require you to be just physically strong has like massively reduced as well.
Yeah, sure.
And I think a more cultural factor that we've talked about some economic factors is just this whole idea of what is gender anyway? You know, why are we talking about it in this binary way? Isn't it all socialized? The idea that there's somehow something fixed about our biology that makes us men and women, that's something that there's a bigger and bigger question mark over in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, that was completely invisible 10 years ago, let's say. I mean, I remember clearly the first time 7 or 8 years ago when I saw someone using my pronouns at the end of their signature on an email and kiddingly went back to them and said, you know, Dave, has someone mistaken you for a woman? You know, so that was my first exposure to that, but that's mushroomed and become a big factor in society. So let's see. I think it's my turn now. You know, maybe the backlash against male sexual aggression that used to be fairly routine and was handled in a fairly routine way has become a real social issue and results in uncertainty and even timidity about sex among many boys and young men. You know, how do I handle, you know, approaching a young woman sexually who I'm attracted to? It used to be fairly straightforward. You know, you were shy to some extent or not, but now it's more complex, right?
Right. I hope that's one we'll dig into. There's some data on that that's just come out. And obviously there's all the stuff about sex recession as well. Another final factor, this is hard to put correctly, but something about the purpose of men when they don't have to die for their country. Actually, the anthropologist Margaret Mead said something like, we'll have to make sure that when we no longer need men to die in a foreign war, that they still have a sense of being needed, a sense of purpose. I think the historic role of men as broadly kind of protectors in a much more warlike world is a real question. So like, you know, what do you do with warrior men when there are now so few, thankfully, so few wars?
Yeah, and when the wars are divorced from the country itself. I mean, in World War II, the entire United States, men, women, and children were engaged in the war effort to some extent. And now they're remote things that you see on TV and the internet, but except for those who are directly engaged and are often badly scarred or killed by it, no one at home really, except families, you know, are directly affected. And so it's kind of like we live in a bubble here, an easy life that's, you know, very easy for most people and easier certainly than it was 80 years ago for almost everyone. And I don't know, like, for example, just to dig into that one, since I think that was probably the last of our batting the ball back and forth across the net here with these ideas. But Recently, a young Mexican man who works with me here on our horse farm in Tennessee related to me something his grandfather had once told him, and I think I'll paraphrase this correctly, that hard times create strong men. Strong men create good times. Good times create weak men, and weak men, in turn, create hard times. So that seems to me to be a very concise and accurate summary of the reality. What do you think about that?
I have heard that. Yeah, it's a very nice way of putting it. What I think it's good at doing is alerting us to the danger of what some people have called the sort of comfort crisis. To some extent, we are getting too comfortable. And there's this interesting sub-movement now of people saying, look, we need to spend more time sleeping outside, doing hard things, you know, doing hard things to our bodies and our minds and so on. And I don't think that's just a male issue, but I think it's plausible that the comfort crisis is having a disproportionate effect on men. If you believe any of the story that you just told about the conditions under which men are strong, then I think it is reasonable just to be appropriately concerned about this. But on the other hand, life is so much better and richer and safer than it has been in previous generations that there's a danger also of getting a bit nostalgic for the world where, quote, real men were real men, you know, and they just drank coffee at dawn and then got on horses and, you know, rode 100 miles before, you know, shootout and coming back and so on, whereas now we're just on our keyboards and on Twitter. And so there's a danger of that becoming a bit of a trope, but also just a bit nostalgic, right? There's a bit of bring backery in it. And honestly, having raised three boys myself, I'm in my 50s now, and I have parents, grandparents, great-grandparents who survived the Blitz, who fought in World War II, fought in World War I. And I got to tell you, I feel very grateful that we live in a world where there is so much less death, so much less violence, and so much less risk. So it's a question of balance. I'm not disagreeing. I'm just saying we shouldn't be careful to make a fetish of conditions that many of the people in them would have been very happy not to be in. You know, my grandmother, who would shelter my father and his brother in the cupboard under the stairs during the Blitz, I think she'd rather have not had to do that. And I'm very glad that I haven't had to do that with my sons. I don't want to overdo the point, but let's keep things in balance, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I was going to repeat your phrase, which you just did, which I think the important part is to try to find a balance. I mean, moderation is the healthiest place to be in almost every aspect of life, I think, you know, rather than at the extremes, because the extremes tend to force the pendulum in the other direction, often to another extreme. And, you know, so,
yeah.
Well, the thing you're talking about of you know, getting outside and doing more physical things, you know, we'll get to that later too. I think there's a difference between urban life and country life in that regard, just necessarily by the nature of the lifestyles that are there. And, you know, I think that's important though, for men in particular, as you said, to engage in more strenuous physical things. And it just does things physically and mentally to and for you that you don't get when, as I say, you're sitting behind a keyboard in an office looking at websites and dealing on the phone and email with people. It's a different kind of life. And there needs to be some balance in there that's much healthier.
I strongly agree with that. When I had sons, a friend said, well, they're like dogs. Make sure you run them out at least twice a day. And of course, there's more to it than that. And there's a sort of stereotype in there as well. But nonetheless, there's a truth to that. And in fact, I was a scout leader for many years. And I was very proud of the fact that we would do quite adventurous things, some quite difficult things that, you know, sometimes injuries would happen. You know, you would get broken bones. You would get, you know, stuff happening, because that's the point. Right. And I do think that there's a risk of taking too much risk out, right? I think there's an appropriate amount of risk in life, especially for boys and young men, and there's an appropriate kind of risk. And there's a danger that if we de-risk society too much, that risk appetite will go somewhere else, or it will lead to some kind of retreat. I was just reflecting on a criticism that Senator Josh Hawley makes of me specifically. He has a new book out on manhood, topically enough. And he describes me as safely ensconced in a think tank. And it's only occurring to me now as I talk to you about this that actually the safely bit was part of the attack, right? It was partly an attack on the elites, think tanks, experts, but the safely ensconced bit was a sort of implied criticism of this kind of milquetoast liberal intellectual who, you know, just his toughest thing he has to do each day is decide whether to have avocado toast again for breakfast, whereas, you know, real men are out there, you know, doing real manly things. And so it is a kind of slur. Safety is also used as something of a slur. So again, I think it's true that we shouldn't have this culture of safetyism and de-risking. I think it also relates, by the way, to the other issue that we sort of batted around, which is this issue of sex and romance. And it might that might seem like an odd connection, but in some ways, of course, there's risk in that. Right? There's a risk in making an approach. There's a risk in exposing yourself to rejection. There's risk in the dance of courting and romance and so on. And I was really struck by the fact that a report just came out very recently from an organization called Equimundo, who work on boys and men. And they asked this big survey, and they found that a third of men between the ages of 18 and 30 say they're worried about being accused of abuse after a sexual encounter. And that's much higher than it was for previous generations. That number is going up for younger men. And now you could easily say, well, you roll your eyes and say, well, that's obviously crazy. It's a bit of a talking point among some of the kind of manosphere guys online talking about this. It's clearly overstated risk. But nonetheless, that's a data point that we shouldn't just ignore, because we don't want men and boys to retreat, especially when there are places for them to retreat to in terms of things like online pornography and alternative. There are alternatives. There are, quotes, safer alternatives, right, online. And so why take risk when there's a safe alternative? But the consequence of all of those de-risking activities, or the retreat from risk, if you like, physically, sexually, emotionally, in every direction, is to create more vulnerability in the long run and more isolation and actually less resilience. So I think there's a kind of lack of resilience theme, I think, that's emerging already in this conversation.
You know, I'm laughing at myself as I listen to you, Richard, because I'm aware of the phrase fools agree, and I'm agreeing with everything you say, so I must be foolish.
Or we both are. It means that the implication is that we both are, yeah. Hopefully everybody listening is passionately disagreeing with us, and therefore we're the only fools.
Or at least they're open-minded, right?
So sure.
You're listening to American Variety Radio, and I'm your host, Court Lewis. We are talking with Dr. Richard Reeves at the Brookings Institution, a senior fellow there, about his specialty, men and boys, maleness, and the societal and cultural factors around it, and in particular, kind of the threats and the struggles of maleness and how it's being affected by trends and changes in our society now. And so that's what we're talking about. Well, let's talk about some of the other contributing factors that we identified earlier, Richard, at the outset. How about the absence of fathers in so many families? That was the one I first mentioned.
That's a huge problem, and it's one that a lot of conservatives are actually sounding the alarm on a long time ago, to be fair. So we had discussions of fatherlessness from people like David Blankenhorn and others back in the 90s. And so I do think there's something important to credit them with there, which is this kind of recognition that dads matter. My issue is how far dads matter only within the context of marriage. But let's put a couple of data points on the table first. One of the things that I was genuinely shocked by when I was doing the research for my book was the following fact. Within 6 years of their parents separating, a third of American children will never see their father again. So conditional on parental separation, after 6 years, the father disappears from the children's lives altogether. That's unconscionable that that's happening. And of course, the fathers themselves have to bear some responsibility, a good deal of it. But I wonder what's happening at a societal level, legally, in terms of policy, in terms of norms, in terms of the expectations we have, which just leads to essentially the benching of so many fathers. And I think that there's actually shared blame between conservatives who say you can only be a good dad if you're married. For them, marriage is a precondition of being a good father, which sends, I think, a very difficult message to the millions of men who are not married to the mothers of their children. But on the other hand, there's sometimes a tendency on the other side of the aisle to be skeptical about the claim that dads matter, for fear that that might somehow make same-sex couples seem inferior, or single mothers to be somehow failing their children, or whatever. And so there's this fear that even accepting the fact that fathers matter will somehow diminish respect for and treatment of other groups. And that's, again, just zero-sum thinking. The evidence for me is pretty overwhelming, in terms of mental health of kids, educational outcomes, long-run mental health, etc., that dads really matter. So one other study that really, really struck me was the strong predictive effect of the relationship that a girl has with her dad, with her own mental health in her early 30s. Like, so that's a decade and a half later, you can still see this very strong predictive line through. And if you think about it for a moment, I think it makes perfect sense. You're a 16-year-old girl. If you have a good relationship with your dad who's helping you navigate the world as a 16-year-old, you have much stronger foundation for your own life. And by the way, it's even more true of boys on a whole bunch of dimensions. But I've deliberately chosen the example of girls because I want to make it clear that dads don't only matter for their sons, but they matter for their children generally. So this epidemic of fatherlessness, I don't think that's an exaggeration, is a huge problem for the kids. But I'll add one more point, which is, and I really got this wrong in my own work, actually. I've written about fathers and how important they are for their kids. And I got this, I've had a bunch of letters, but one in particular from a dad who just said, listen, Richard, I like your work, but can you stop talking about dads as if they only matter for the outcomes for their kids? What about being a dad? What about the importance of fatherhood for us? And as a father myself, of course, I was just knocked back on my heels. And I thought, wow, I've really got that wrong. And that actually being a father is hugely important for the well-being of men. And not only that, but increasingly so, because they don't necessarily have the traditional role of breadwinner. We mentioned the fact that they might not be. There's all kinds of things about male purpose now, a real question mark over what are men for. One thing we can be sure of is that they're for being fathers. And so I've now really rebalanced my own view. And I really think, as I said, I didn't emphasize enough that fatherhood matters not only for children, but for the fathers themselves as well.
Yeah, I would think it gives you a sense of self-respect, and it helps in your continued maturation as a human being too. I mean, to be responsible on a continuing daily basis for someone. But I guess whether it's conservative or liberal or not, it seems to me that still many fathers who just dump the family, that's a dereliction of duty that to me is inexcusable, really. I mean, if you have the responsibility to, whether you intended or not, to become a father, have a woman bear your children, then you have a deep responsibility to those offspring, it seems to me. Now, maybe I'm conservative in that regard, but I don't think so. I think it's just a human necessity and an obligation.
Well, the fool's agreeing thing may be a bit too, but I have to tell you that if the idea that fathers have an unconditional moral responsibility to their children is a conservative idea, God help us, honestly.
Right.
I mean, that's like, but I fear you might be right that for some people that might sound a bit conservative. I think what's conservative is to say that you can only meet your responsibilities as an engaged and responsible father if you are and remain married to the mum. I'm not suggesting, of course, that it isn't better and easier in many ways for that to be the case. But I worry that the message from the right is, okay, so you're not married, you've already failed. That's just a different way of telling men they've failed from the one that the left has got. But what's clear is, if you have a child, that's an irreversible decision and an unconditional responsibility.
Yeah, I mean, there used to be a thing when I was a kid and maybe through the 70s that even in unhappy marriages, the couple would stay together, quote, for the sake of the children. Then the onus disappeared against divorce, and the divorce rate skyrocketed to, what, 50% or more or whatever. But I think even being divorced, you can still be good parents, cooperating as partners in the parenting of your offspring.
Exactly.
Without
you're
necessarily living together or loving each other anymore.
That's right. You can co-parent even if you're not co-resident. And actually the evidence is, as fathers are separating from their children, many of them are remaining very engaged. So I gave you that statistic earlier about, you know, a third of kids will lose touch with their father altogether. But at the other end of the spectrum, there's a huge amount of engagement on the part of fathers. So today, for example, after a divorce, fathers are getting about a third of the time with the kids overall. That's the average kind of overall. And there are very few sole custody decisions now. Now, of course, the people getting married, I think they're selecting into that kind of parental responsibility because marriage rates have dropped. So I think the people who are choosing to get married are also choosing to be parents. And that decision to become a parent and the commitment to becoming a parent survives this dissolution of the relationship. So I think the key thing is that we can't allow being a divorced dad to be an excuse for being a deadbeat dad. There's no excuse for being a deadbeat dad, but you know, the world is as it is. And I don't think anybody wants to go back to a world where people didn't feel they could divorce if the relationship was failing badly.
So Richard, I can see already that this is going to be one of those shows that I wish we were an hour long rather than half an hour long. But let's kind of move to another thing. You talked about the emergence of women into the workforce and their increasing professional and financial clout vis-a-vis men. And, you know, when I was a kid, people laughed about, quote, the battle between the sexes. And I think at that time, in the 50s and 60s, it was a very uneven battle. I mean, women had almost no weapons at their disposal. But with the increasing professional and financial strength they have now, backed up by laws, I think that women are now winning that battle. I mean, what would you say about all that?
Yeah, I don't like the framing, honestly. I think that the battle of the sexes traps us in a zero-sum framing, right? Almost
sure.
By definition, you can only have one winner of a battle. And so it sets up this idea that for one sex to do better, the other one has to do worse. I think it made more sense in a world where women were genuinely kind of fighting for all kinds of rights and were disadvantaged on a whole range of fronts. But that's largely not true anymore. And most of the women I speak to, including those who probably describe themselves as very feminist and progressives, think that a world of floundering men is not like to be a world of flourishing women. And we do have to rise together. But where I will agree is that the economic rise of women, which was the fundamental goal of that wave of the post-war women's movement, which was to secure more economic independence for women so that they weren't economically dependent on a man. Right? The freedom would only come from economic independence. That was the central insight of that generation of feminists, and they were right. And secondly, they've been spectacularly successful. So today, back in 1979, 13% of women earned more than the typical man. Today, 40% of women earn more than the typical man. That's a world transformed. 40% of breadwinners are women. In a third, almost a third of marriages now, the wife earns as much or more than the husband. This is a completely different world to the one we just had just a generation ago. I mean, it's just, this is an extraordinary transformation in the economic relation between men and women, which has, by and large, achieved this goal of economic independence for women. But that, in turn, has raised very profound questions about the role of men, about the shape of the family, about the idea of breadwinning. I mean, it's a revolution in many ways. And I think we're still coming to terms with it. In particular, we haven't yet come up with a very good answer of what happens to men in a world where women don't need them economically. And again, a lot of conservatives were saying they won't be needed. That will be a disaster. That's why we shouldn't support women's rights. Now, they were wrong to suggest, of course, that you should either A, could or would want to hold back the rise of women. But they were right to say that that was going to pose real questions. And then when you talk to women's leaders about that, particularly those who were involved in the big fights of the 70s and 80s, they would quite rightly say, look, it's not up to us to reinvent purposes for men. Look, we're trying to fight for women. So who is doing that? And right now, almost no one is really grappling with the question of what does it mean to be a good man today in a world where we've got much more gender equality and we've changed the landscape. The social and cultural landscape has been utterly transformed in a generation. And we're only just beginning to come to terms with that. And then you add to that the inability to have a good conversation, particularly in politics or just in public generally. And then I think that we're kind of creating a vacuum, which is being filled, unfortunately, by a lot of bad actors, both online and elsewhere.
Yeah, I think, that's, you're leading into kind of the negative implications of this kind of trend, and the backlash against it, I think, is part of what's behind the rise of extremely aggressive male groups like the Proud Boys. I mean, there's the name right out front, right? The Proud Boys are having a big impact on politics, and it's kind of the upside down version of wokeness, in a sense, when you think about it. Do you agree?
Yeah, I think that's the danger. I think that there's this kind of, the nature of polarization in this area, as in most others, is that each side sort of sharpens the knife of the other. That's, if you like think about a knife sharpener, it's almost like the left sharpens the knife of the right and vice versa, and pushes each other into ever more extreme and competitive positions. And so I think it's true to say that the denial on the left that there are problems for boys and men, and sometimes the denial even that there are differences between men and women, just creates an understandable backlash on the right. But then on the right, what you see is this sense of, that's why we should go back 50 years. That's this kind of implication that the rise of women is to blame for the fall of men, which is not true. But they're then able to blame the mainstream media, etc., for attacking men. And there's enough truth in that critique for it to sound plausible. And so just the cycle turns, essentially. And most people are worried about their sons, worried about their daughters, trying to get by, recognizing that, of course, there are differences between men and women, and they're facing some different challenges, but that by and large, they're not huge differences. And they certainly shouldn't determine what someone's allowed to or not allowed to do in life. And they find the frothy, stratospheric rhetoric of the people above them on the left and right to be profoundly unhelpful to their attempts to get their son a good education and find a good career for their daughter and help them have kids and find a good partner and raise a family. I mean, it's just like, it's so far away from what most people are actually struggling with. But it is nonetheless interesting that people are now increasingly worried about their son And that is kind of a real trend in the surveys now, where you're seeing parents, including liberal parents, who are really worried about their boys. And of course, they should be worried about their boys, and because their boys are more likely to be struggling, especially in education, in terms of social isolation, all kinds of issues. The suicide rate is 4 times higher among young men than young women, and rose by 8% just in 1 year, from 2020 to 2021. So it's all kinds of reasons why you should be worried about your boys, in similar but different ways, in some cases, to the way you're worried about your girls. But there's this sense at the moment that you're only allowed to care about one, right? You either care about boys or you care about girls. And if you care about boys, you're on the right. If you care about girls, you're on the left. And you have to choose. And to me, that's the equivalent of saying to someone who, say, has a son and a daughter, that they're only allowed to care about one of them. It's insane and unconscionable to set this up as a zero-sum game when it is quite clear that there are all kinds of problems facing boys and men now, as well as ongoing problems for girls and women, some of which are the same, some of which are different, and that we should just responsibly address, like a responsible parent would address the fact that their son is struggling at school and the girl is struggling with some mental health issues or vice versa or whatever. But we don't seem to have that parental responsibility mindset among so many of our institutional leaders right now. They'd rather pit us against each other than help us solve the actual problems that we're facing in our real lives.
Well, gosh, I wish we had more time, because there's a lot more I'd like to talk with you about on this subject, but we are about out of time. So let me try to get to a wrap up. You know, getting back to what I said the Mexican grandfather said, and that you said you'd heard before, is this kind of thing a natural cyclical thing? And just answer briefly if you can, because we don't have much time, but is it possible to regain a healthier balance, or is it maybe a terminal situation? And what do you see as the outlook for the future in this, just quickly?
I think we're at a really crucial phase. We might be just going through the growing pains, a transition to a world where we've got much more gender equality. Boys and men are going to have to figure out what that means, and we'll get through it. But we're just recalibrating our ideas of masculinity and male role to this new world, gender equality. And it'll take time, but we'll get there. There's a more pessimistic view, which is that unless we start to address this issue now, that these differences are just going to escalate, and that more and more boys and men will either retreat or fall out of society one way or the other. And then it'll get harder and harder to solve. And so I actually believe that the next 10 to 20 years are absolutely critical for answering that question, because I think it's perfectly possible to help boys and men through this transition, take their problems seriously, all rise together. I also think it's possible that for different reasons, we might fail. We might just fail to recognize the scale of this problem. And if we don't recognize it, then it will go unaddressed. If the problems of boys and men go unaddressed, they will fester and things will get worse. So there's still plenty of time, I think, to stop that decline into what would be a very difficult world for boys and men. But we don't have very much time left, in my view, to act.
So we're going to have to leave it there. You know, I guess we'll cross our fingers and hope that a more healthy and salubrious outcome of this takes place. But I think we've at least done a little bit here to let a lot of people think more about this, be more aware of this trend and this topic and what it portends.
let's hope so.
So again, Richard Reeves' book of Boys and Men is available at the usual online outlets, you know, Barnes & Noble and Amazon and so on. And you can Google him at brookings.edu or on YouTube and see more of his talks on this and other subjects. Richard, thanks so much for being on with us here on American Variety.
Thank you for having me on, Court. Great conversation.
Yeah, it was. And thanks to all of you out there for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.